This morning's passage constitutes the emotional heart of what is often regarded as the great portrait of friendship in the Old Testament. David and Jonathan's friendship is a friendship abounding in loyalty and affection. It's a friendship that negotiates reversals of personal fortune, that test friendship's longing for reciprocity and equality of status. It's a friendship that powerfully illustrates what can happen when the claims of family and friends come into conflict with each other. And it does all these things in the context of in the years leading up to a protracted and bloody civil war in which Saul's descendants will lose out to the superior nous and military prowess of the former courtier turned warlord, David, son of Jesse the Bethlehemite. Last week, I identified this larger context with the so-called history of David's rise. That is the stretch of narrative that extends all the way from 1 Samuel 16 to 2 Samuel 5. And before we enter into the passage we've just had read for us by Maria, we'll do well to glance quickly over this story as it's unfolded over the three intervening chapters. Our passage last week ended with David, clandestinely anointed by the prophet Samuel, installed in the Saulite court as none other than Saul's armor bearer. The following chapter, chapter 17, notoriously provides a second version of this initial meeting between David and Saul, this time with Saul placing his own armor on David prior to the latter's contest with Goliath, an action which ironically foreshadows how everything of Saul's, the affection of his family members, the loyalty of his subjects, and finally his very kingdom, will likewise find its way into the hands of his younger rival. In chapter 18, Saul's mounting jealousy of David leads him to dangle before him the hand of Michal, his daughter, for which he sets the gruesome bridal price of 100 Philistine foreskins. Gross. The Philistines, however, fail to polish off Jesse's son, and Saul, now with his great rival established as his son-in-law, takes matters into his own hands, hurling his spear at David as the latter plays upon the lyre, and then in a further attempt at murder dispatches men to assassinate David, whose wife in effect chooses her husband over her father as she bundles David out of the house via a window to safety. Chapter 20, our chapter, now shifts the focus to David's relationship with Michal's brother, Jonathan. Jonathan entered the book of Samuel back in chapter 13 as a valiant warrior whose pluck turns a desperate situation for the Israelite army into an unlikely victory, but whose unwitting violation of a ritual prohibition that very same day leads to his being cursed by his own father and then almost stoned, a fate from which he's rescued only by the insistence of the army. Now, Saul's curse hangs over his son for the following chapters of the book, chapters which also detail the rise to prominence of Saul's successor, David. And as next in line to the throne, we expect Jonathan, to treat David as a rival. But instead, immediately after David slays Goliath, we read, Jonathan became one in spirit with David. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. After David's military successes arouse Saul's jealousy, he finds himself obliged to flee the king's presence. Jonathan then acts as David's defender before his father Saul, after which David is able to return to court. Here at the beginning of chapter 20, David has again been forced into hiding, but nonetheless seeks out Jonathan in yet another attempt to gain his protection. Well, given that Saul has now made three attempts on David's life, Jonathan's response to David's request is somewhat surprising. Never, Jonathan replies. You're not going to die. Look, my father never does anything without letting me know. Why would he hide this from me? It isn't so. What's going on here? Well, all of us find ourselves at some time in our lives denying what's obvious to everyone around us, simply because we shrink from acknowledging the pain that the truth would entail. And here, I suspect that Jonathan is deluding himself simply because he's tired of balancing painfully divided loyalties. He owes obedience to Saul, both as a son and a subject. But David he loves as himself. Well, David tactfully suggests that Saul's failure to inform Jonathan of his plans is motivated less by suspicion of his son than it is by a desire to avoid causing Jonathan unnecessary suffering. Nevertheless, as he tells Jonathan, with perhaps an allusion back to those quick steps that had allowed him to dodge Saul's spear in previous chapters, there's only a step between me and death. The allusion, if that's what it is, works. Jonathan commits himself to sounding out his father. Now, because I want to hone in on the nature of the relationship between David and Jonathan, at this point I'm going to try to stop capturing the movement of the dialogue and to step back so as to highlight some of its more striking features. And the first thing I want to draw attention to is that welter of oaths that David and Jonathan use to assure each other of their continued affection and loyalty for each other. As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, David says to Jonathan in verse 3, I swear by the Lord. The God of Israel, says Jonathan in verse 12. And in verse 42, Jonathan tells David to go in peace, for we have sworn friendship with each other in the name of the Lord, saying the Lord is witness between you and me and between your descendants and my descendants forever. One reaction to the multiplication of oaths might well be cynicism. Behind the oath we may feel, might there not lie the wish to conceal or perhaps to silence an uneasy conscience? David, after all, is steeling himself for life as an outcast, as Saul's declared enemy. Jonathan's repeated assurances that his father poses no danger to David must have sounded hollow even to himself. And both these young men are perfectly well aware that at Saul's death, one must reign over the other. On the other hand, perhaps the accumulation of oaths has more to do with the heightened emotion of the scene in general. Both men feel that a decisive moment in the friendship has dawned. It's time for restating basic commitments and loyalties in the most forceful way possible, so that such assurances of mutual affection may function as anchors in the coming storm. As the writer of the letter to the Hebrews notes, oaths are sworn to confirm what is said and to put an end to all argument. God swears an oath in Psalm 110, according to the same writer, because he wanted to make the unchanging nature of his purpose very clear. And perhaps something similar is taking place here. There are moments when a crisis in the life of a friend can demand, if not an oath, at least an emphatic declaration by word or deed that we're in our friend's corner. Perhaps you need to tell your friend that you'll still be there for them, even though they've decided to walk away from living for Christ. Or maybe your friend is grieving and you book a flight to go and see them, even though you know that the visit will be full of painful silences and conversational blunders as you struggle to find something to say that won't just make things worse. Maybe it's turning up in court when your friend has broken the law. Jesus not only calls himself our friend, but he shows us his commitment to us in dying for us. Whenever I think that my relationship with him is superficial, then it's helpful to remind myself that Jesus is more committed to me than I could ever fathom. Never will I leave you. Never will I forsake you, is one way the Bible summarizes God's basic attitude to us in Jesus. These are words of life, words to feed on your whole life long, words that in the bleaker moments of a Christian's life carry a special weight as a pledge of Jesus' eternal friendship with us. The next feature I want to pick up on is quite closely related to the first, and that is the presence of the language of covenant. Covenant is a term with huge emotional resonance in the Bible. In the ancient Near East, a covenant was a binding agreement made between two parties which was sealed with oaths and solemnized with sacrifices. It was, insofar as we know it from surviving evidence, primarily a political and legal tool. In the Bible, we have evidence of covenants made between individuals and between nations, and these are typically formulated using highly conventional language. In the Old Testament, covenant making is transferred from the legal and political sphere into the sphere of religion. God himself famously makes a covenant with his people, Israel, at Mount Sinai. And covenant, with its key elements of promise-making and relational commitment, arguably becomes the central religious idea of the Old Testament as a whole. Now, the language of covenant is also prominent throughout the material relating to David and Jonathan's friendship. It was right there at the beginning of the relationship, wasn't it? In that passage that I cited in verse 3 of chapter 18. It's present later on too in verse 18 of chapter 23, but it's particularly prominent in our chapter, chapter 20. In verse 8, David appeals to the covenant made back in chapter 18 when he says, "As for you, show kindness to your servant, for you have brought him into a covenant with you before the Lord. If I am guilty, kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father?" David here makes explicit that the covenant the two men have entered upon was initiated by Jonathan, and it was one in which Jonathan served as the senior partner, which is what one would expect, really, given that Jonathan must be older and his heir apparent to the throne. David uses the obligations of that covenant, the religious element of which is stressed here, to override the powerful ties of kinship and fealty which bind Jonathan to his father Saul. In verse 16, Jonathan reaffirms the initial covenant with David, pledging loyalty to David and calling on the Lord to bring David's enemies to account. And then he has David reaffirm his oath out of love for him. But the full meaning of what Jonathan has asked David to do emerges only when we appreciate that Hebrew uses the idiom to cut a covenant for what appears in English more blandly as to make a covenant. In verse 15, Jonathan has asked David not to cut off lo tichrit, his kindness from his family, and then in verse 16 proceeds to cut vayichrot, a covenant with the house of David, all of which must have seemed deeply poignant to the first readers of 1 and 2 Samuel, who no doubt knew of the bitter civil war fought between David and Saul's descendants after Jonathan and Saul's deaths. Now, for many of us, I think, the prominence of covenant language with its accent on formal promise-making and a spelling out of just what a particular relationship entails in terms of duties and privileges is going to feel basically antithetical to the spirit of friendship as we conceive it. For us, at least, you know, ideally, friendship is all about freedom. Marriage and parenthood and business relationships, well, they all entail legal responsibilities. Friendships don't. You don't get to choose your family, but you do get to choose your friends. And yet, I've said that the Old Testament knows about covenants between nations and covenants between individuals. And it would be wonderful to know whether the covenant of friendship that David and Jonathan entered into was a relatively common or a relatively rare phenomenon, but the reality of the evidence we have is that we just can't answer that very interesting question. Thinking about the first Christians, it's kind of striking that apart from, say, Jesus' comments about friendship in John's Gospel, the New Testament has relatively little to say about friendship. The first Christians thought of themselves not as friends so much as siblings, which I think, amongst other things, is a way of capturing the first Christian sense that becoming Christian wasn't something that they'd chosen for themselves, but which they'd arrived at as a result of God's will. Again, you choose your friends, but you don't get to choose your brothers and sisters. The absence of friendship, comparatively, in New Testament writing is even more striking when we put it into the context of the contemporary status of friendship in the Greco-Roman world. Greco-Roman philosophers were really interested in friendship. It was esteemed. They produced this big body of literature on friendship. And in many places, it was kind of esteemed above the bonds of marriage. And it's interesting that Christian writing on friendship really only blossomed with the appropriation of Greco-Roman writers that took place in the 4th century AD. At the same time, not insignificantly, as monasticism began to assert itself as one of the distinctive ways of being a Christian. Now, we live in a time in which Christian writers generally have a lot to say about marriage, but in which fewer and fewer people get married. A time in which adults often live in share houses or on their own, a time in which frequent moves for work and technological advances provide fresh opportunities and fresh challenges for friendships. We also live in a culture that's increasingly articulate about its loneliness, both inside and outside marriages. And so it's worth asking, is the covenant-making practice of David and Jonathan, rather than just being a sign of formalism and inauthenticity in a friendship, actually a sign of strength and something that could be of value in our culture, characterized as it is by the rise of the importance of friendships and in the corresponding threat of loneliness? Well, one way that longer-term friendships in our culture tend to embed themselves in more formalized ways is through the relationships that develop between you and your friends' children. My mum's best friend, for example, is known to me and my sister as Aunty Bindi. And Aunty Bindi, of course, is very much part of our family. She was present at every single one of my birthdays as I grew up. She came to my school concerts, and we were often guests in her house. And my guess is that many of you here either are an Aunty Bindi or you have one in your lives. Weaving our friendships into the parallel structure of our family relationships is one quite organic way of covenanting friendship. Another way of formalizing friendships has to do with how friends get incorporated into the big moments of your life and even your death. As an example, I remember when Cynthia, who is a friend at church, died a few years ago. Her nephew Stephen, when planning the funeral service, deliberately asked friends from different spheres of Cynthia's life to put together eulogies to honour her. And his reasoning for this was that friends had been such a vital part of her life. And the result, for those of you who were there, was very moving. The night before Jesus died, he invited his friends to share in the Passover meal with him, radically reinterpreting it so as to formalize his relationship with his friends in a way that they could draw on over the years to come, so as to sustain them in their faith until the end. When they drank wine together, he said, "This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many." According to Jesus, his death for us formalizes our relationship with him. And every time we take communion, we remember that our relationship with Jesus isn't based on how spiritual we might be feeling at that moment. It's not based on our religious performance over the course of the past week. But it's based on his death for us and on the eternal love that stands behind that death. Jesus has cut a covenant with us, a lasting, living testament that sets out with perfect clarity just how much he loves us. The third and last thing I want to pick up on in today's passage is its emphasis on physical affection as an ingredient in friendship. In verse 41, David, having heard in code what effectively amounts to his own death sentence, comes out into the open and approaches Jonathan. He bows down three times to the ground before Jonathan with his face to the ground. They kiss each other. They weep together. Now, this scene powerfully reminds me of two of the reconciliation scenes described in Genesis. The first between Jacob and Esau in Genesis 33, the second between Joseph and his brothers in Genesis 45. And this scene, like those others, is a scene full of high emotion, in which the contrast between current danger and lasting solidarity and affection stands out. Now, touch is quite a difficult thing to speak about with precision because what feels appropriate in one culture can be interpreted quite differently in another. And this is strikingly illustrated in the case of 1 Samuel 20 by the persistent minority of modern interpreters who see in David and Jonathan's exchange a homoerotic element. But even within the one culture, what one person craves, another person really doesn't want. And I don't actually have any advice for you except to say that love will generally be able to find out a way to work out what amount of physical affection different friends need. What I do want to draw attention to, however, is the cumulative effect of all those times in the Gospels when the author draws attention to how Jesus touched others or submitted to their touch. He's willing to touch and be touched by what his contemporaries thought repulsive. The leper in Mark 1, the woman subject to bleeding in Mark 5, the sinful woman in Luke 7. Jesus is willing to touch people no one else will. Now, sometimes we do things that make us ashamed to look at ourselves in the mirror, things that make our flesh crawl, things that make us feel soiled. But Jesus' friendship is stronger than sin, stronger than shame, stronger than dirt. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your deep, deep love for us. Thank you for your loving kindness, your faithfulness, your everlasting friendship with us. In Jesus' name, amen.